Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this evening. We are about to have a conversation with Scott Shane, reporter for the New York Times Washington Bureau, who co-wrote the piece in the last weekend called Secret Kill List, Test Obama's Principles, an interesting, fascinating article that generated much discussion. Sam Faddis joins us as well. He's a former CIA operations officer and author of Willful Neglect, The Dangerous Illusion of Homeland Security. Umar Farouk joins us, independent journalist in New York, who wrote a piece called Our Immoral Drone War for Slate. And Scott, Sam, and Umar, welcome. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thanks for having us.
And the number here, folks, is 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages and leave your comments there as well. Scott, this is, as soon as I read the article, I knew we had to have some discussion on this. People have been talking about it for a while. But I'm curious, as you kind of research this piece and the other piece you wrote, Assessing Obama's Counterterrorism Record, what for you were revelations you were not expecting in this discourse about Obama's targeted killings?
Well, I guess the most striking thing was the degree to which the president kind of took personal control or a personal role in running the program. It's probably not fair to say running the program, but overseeing the program.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the drone strikes date all the way back to 2002, but they were escalated significantly in the last 6 months or so of President Bush's second term in Pakistan. But we were told that while he wanted sort of detailed after-action reports, he didn't get involved much beforehand in either approving names added to this kill or capture list or in actually approving the strikes themselves. And President Obama has actually taken a pretty expansive role. He is, we were told that he wants to approve, sign off on all the names added to the kill list, and he personally has approved the strikes outside Pakistan in Yemen and a few in Somalia, and he's wanted to sign off on the kind of riskier strikes in Pakistan, strikes where the CIA judges that there's a significant risk of civilian casualties. So it's, I guess, the most striking thing to me was that role that he took on, and we were kind of curious to talk to his aides about why that was.
And the why, before we turn to Sam and Umar to really flesh this out with you, it's that part of what reading your article said, the difference between the two presidencies, whether you agree with the targeted killings and drone attacks or not, was a president who kind of took a very deeply philosophical look in terms of what war means and what his role in war means, to the point of actually looking at the photographs of those who may be targeted beforehand and that taking responsibility for that, that's the shift that beyond the political discussion, which we'll also have, that I found really interesting.
Yeah, the administration's argument, which we maybe don't we don't really get into maybe in as much as we should, is that whatever the disputes are about civilian casualties in the drone strikes, and I've written a number of articles about that.
Mm-hmm.
If you begin with the premise that somehow the United States is going to go uproot, capture, or kill terrorist al-Qaeda folks who are plotting against the U.S., who they think are plotting against the U.S., obviously, if we send 100,000 troops into Pakistan to do the job, we would have 10 years of war and tens of thousands of civilian casualties. If we did flew over and did traditional bombing runs as in Vietnam, there would be certainly thousands upon thousands of civilian casualties. So they make the case, which a lot of people on the outside accept, that even if you take the high-end estimates of civilian casualties in the drone strikes, it's still a relatively precise military technology with less collateral damage than the traditional modes of warfare.
And I was commenting earlier also, and we'll turn here to Sam and then to Umar, is what the President Obama takes, as you said, moral responsibility for the decisions he's made, and was really wrestling with the, which we've talked about in the show before, the just war theories of Augustus and Thomas Aquinas and others. I mean, that's that to me was kind of a, those was that and the way he decided to do this personally were kind of stunning revelations.
Yeah, you know, it's remarkable to go back and read or watch his Nobel Peace Prize address.
Mm-hmm.
As people will remember, he won the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, not long after becoming president. And in the middle of escalating drone strikes in Pakistan, and he accepted the prize just before expanding these strikes into Yemen. And he talked about just war theory in his Nobel Prize address, but it's, you know, I mean, I think he's quite aware of the kind of moral complications of what he's up to. Whether you accept, you know, his and his aide's explanations for this stuff or not.
So, Sam Faddison and Umar Farooq, I'm glad you both are with us. And Sam, I mean, I know that having interviewed you many times and having been a guest on the show many times in the past. Your work in the CIA, I mean, you have talked about wrestling with the kind of moral issues that you had to do, what you did, but you did them. And I'm curious what you think of what the article put out and what it says about these targeted killings and whether they are, from your perspective, the logical next step for how America wages war.
Well, I think the unfortunate truth is that given where we are and given the threats we face, that I personally think that you're going to find that this kind of action is necessary and it's justified. But a couple of factors I would point out. I mean, so one would be the scope of this. Okay, we have now gone from a program that was focused on a very small number of select individuals who were basically identified by concrete intelligence to what the military would call signature strikes, which is their terminology for strikes on targets where we don't know who's in a vehicle or in a house, but based on certain criteria, we've decided that this is an enemy vehicle or this is an enemy house. That's a dramatic expansion from where this started when it first began. And the second would be, I guess, just to juxtapose the whole thing with this, that we have terminated any attempt to capture and hold people because of the political implications, because this administration does not want to deal with the political implications of that, having put so much emphasis on closing Gitmo and that kind of thing. But we are continuing this, and that is, there's a certain amount, I don't know, that just strikes me a little odd that we're so terrified of the human rights issues involved with holding a person in detention that we would prefer to kill them and deny them all human rights as opposed to make any attempt to capture them, which I'm not suggesting that in all situations there would be an option for capture. I'm saying it's been completely effectively, for political reasons, taken completely off the table now. There is only one button that is pushed, and that is to kill people.
And Umar Farooq, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us. I mean, in the piece that you wrote, Our Immoral Drone War, one of the things you wrote about were these kinds of two kinds of drone targets, the signature targets and the personality targets. And I'm curious, given what you've heard in this conversation so far, if you just begin with your take on it all.
Well, I think that we should keep in mind that there's two different spheres of discussion. There's a sphere of discussion domestically when we're talking about whether or not what the president is doing is in accordance with international or domestic law, whether it's constitutional, whether we think it's strategically important. And then there's another sphere, which is what the West, you know, the rest of the world thinks about this and what people on the ground think about this. So sort of that's what I think we're sort of missing from this discussion. We talked about the Nobel Peace Prize. Well, the most recent Nobel Peace Prize winner, the Yemeni, Tawakkul Karman, she just recently, a few weeks ago, reiterated that drone strikes in her country are not helping, and they're not killing terrorists, and they're also killing civilians. So we should really keep in mind sort of what the international image of this issue is. I'd also like to say a couple of things about the New York Times article.
Please.
I thought it's quite interesting that it comes at this point in the cycle of our national elections. It's sort of repainting Obama as some sort of not just like a tough guy on terrorism, but like this guy with amazing lawyer skills that we can sort of trust in the Oval Office, who knows what he's doing, and he has to make these tough moral decisions. And I just wonder if we had a Republican president in place of Obama, would we even be, you know, framing the conversation in this way, or would we be ready to sort of condemn what he's doing? You know, so those are sort of the things that go through my mind.
Well, let's wrestle with some of the things that the article brought out. And we can start with what you just brought out, Umar. Scott, I mean, I'd like to hear your response to what Umar said, and Sam as well. I mean, there were people who attacked George Bush for his drone attacks, for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, as you describe in the article, here's President Barack Obama kind of wrestling with this in a very personal way. And taking charge of it in a way that the previous president did not. Does that make a difference? Are we painting a picture here? I'm not saying you're painting this picture, but is that part of what the picture that the White House and folks that you interviewed are painting of this tough man with moral courage who we should follow?
I think it was an interesting to get a range of reactions to that article. Some thought it was an attack on Obama. Some thought it was somehow put up by the White House. We didn't set out to do any of that. I mean, I think there are very, very interesting legal, moral, and political questions that surround this program, and we certainly tried to write the article in a critical way. To add some new details to just the factual basis of the program. For example, I don't think it had previously been reported that the CIA, when it counts civilian casualties in these strikes, essentially assumes that military-aged males who are hit in the strikes are militants, are fighters, are legitimate combatants, and not civilians, which may explain some of the very, very low official government estimates of civilian casualties in the strikes. Some of what they have done is, certainly out on the edge legally, and it's been very controversial. I think there's a kind of interesting analogy between the Bush administration, for example, adopting something like waterboarding, interrogation method where you basically half drown somebody, and basing that method or the use of that method on a secret legal opinion from the Justice Department. There's an analogy between that and the Obama administration killing an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki, the cleric who had joined the al-Qaeda branch in Yemen, killing him with a drone based, again, on a secret legal opinion, which they have refused to make public. You know, one can support or decry either of those actions, but they're, you know, it's hard to miss a little bit of parallelism. And I do think that Obama has probably... Certainly, let's put it this way. Bush administration officials we interviewed for that article believe that Obama has gotten relatively a pass from other countries and from the kind of human rights community on this program relative to what Bush would have faced. As one Bush administration official said, if Bush had ordered the killing of an American in Yemen, as Obama did, he said the bonfires would still be burning in Lafayette Square. and there's probably something to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sam, I don't know if you're aware on this particular thing. I'm going to jump into some of the real specific points the article pulled out and what they say about where America's going and where should we be going. But you have any thoughts on what we've just been talking about?
Well, I certainly agree with that there's a little bit of a double standard here. I mean, that absolutely the Bush administration would have would have sort of been raked over the coals in this. And the other thing I would say is that, I mean, it's great to paint this picture. I guess I'm a little bit lost as to why the President of the United States would be personally looking at this list and agonizing over names that go on it. I mean, he's not approving the names of everybody that a Marine shoots at in Helmand Province or the names of individuals that are bombed in other interventions. I mean, I think that's... I just don't understand the dual standard.
You're skeptical of that?
Say again?
You're skeptical of that?
I have no doubt that he does it. That's not what I'm saying. I just wonder why the agonizing over that when there are thousands of people being killed otherwise in combat operations where we don't require that the President of the United States authorize us to pull the trigger. I think that sort of moralizing over the issue is just maybe, I don't know, maybe that makes him feel better. I don't know.
let me tackle some of the harder issues this article brought up. And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Scott Shane, who co-wrote the article, Secret Kill List, Test Obama's Principles for the New York Times, which is on our website, along with the other things that Scott and others have been writing. Scott has been writing in the New York Times. Sam Faddis, former CIA operations officer, author of Willful Neglect, The Dangerous Illusion of Homeland Security, among many other books, and as a security consultant, Umar Farouk, independent journalist in New York, who wrote a piece called Our Memorial, Immoral Drone War for Slate. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But one of the things the article talked about here, and I think that you even quoted in the article, Scott, Will Litzau, Deputy Assistant Secretary, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Detainee Policy, that the embrace of drone strikes suggests that he's adopted a no-prisoner strategy, which is what Sam has mentioned earlier. So what does that mean? I mean, what does that mean about what we're saying about how we're conducting what we're calling this war on terror around the world? As Iraq simmers, troops out of Iraq, as Afghanistan takes on a different texture as a war but remains, but this is a different policy. What does that say about where we're going, what the dangers are ahead, and what this could mean?
Well, the concern that has been expressed by folks outside the government and certainly privately within is whether, there's a couple different concerns. One is this idea that somehow they have either decided or that at least there is the perception that they've decided to take no prisoners. And it is striking that they have killed, hundreds of people in these countries, meaning Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and they have only taken one prisoner, a guy who was held on a ship for about 70 days while they tried to figure out what to do with him. Eventually they decided they could charge him in regular criminal court, and he's now, awaiting trial. And in fact, cooperating with the prosecutors against other folks. But there is this, Obama decided he didn't want to add any more prisoners to Guantanamo. So there's some perception that they don't want to go through the huge political problems and the very difficult, divisive issues that are raised when, for example, Bush did take people into custody. And, of course, there were controversies over interrogation. There were controversies over where the people were. There were controversies over whether they would be tried by the military or in regular court. There's controversies over holding some of them indefinitely without charges. And, so some people think to avoid all those hassles, the Obama administration has basically just decided to kill folks.
Right.
And they deny that. Certainly Obama administration officials claim that they would prefer, if they can, to take people into custody, to question them, to get intelligence from them, and so on. But not much of that has gone on, and they say that's because it's very, very difficult and dangerous to try to catch anyone in Pakistan's tribal areas or Yemen's tribal areas. But I guess the larger question also that looms behind all this is this weird new technology that allows them to, without risking American lives, fly a robotic plane into another country, study the people on the ground for hours or days or weeks, and then take a shot at somebody. And I think there's a lot of concern even within the administration about, where do we go from here? When do they decide, hey, We've killed most of the dangerous people in Pakistan. We're not going to do it there anymore. We're going to stop doing it in Yemen. What if they want to hunt down drug dealers or drug kingpins
right.
in some other country? What if the Russians decide that there's some Chechen terrorists in Georgia and float drones over there and kill them? I mean, there is a sense of sort of Pandora's box being opened here, and real serious questions, and you know about the precedent the U.S. is setting.
Umar, I'm really curious as to your take on where this takes us.
It's definitely setting an interesting and I think clearly troublesome precedent in America in terms of whoever the next president is and whoever's the president after him. You can imagine now, even if you're somehow magically comfortable with Obama because, he speaks well or he dresses nice, if you're comfortable with him sitting in the Oval Office making these decisions, what if Mitt Romney is elected president? Or what if the next guy after Mitt Romney turns out to be even worse than Mitt Romney? What kind of moral issues are you going to have with that person running the same type of program that we've given all this authority to run, On the other hand, I'd want to say that, legally, there might be loopholes here for the U.S. to go about doing these types of things, these doctrines of necessity and imminent threat and hot pursuit and all these legal loopholes. But to the rest of the world, this is clearly, a program of targeted killing, of murder in these countries. And, we can get however many, Islamophobes in Pakistan or Yemen or dictators in Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia or any other country to sit down with us and give us verbal agreements saying that we could do this behind their back and they won't say anything. At the end of the day, the population there is clearly not going to stand for their neighborhood being bombed from the sky. I wanted to give one example really quickly about, there was a case that was touched on in the New York Times article. It was the killing of Baitullah Masood, one of the biggest, leaders of the Taliban in Pakistan, a man that allegedly is responsible for, hundreds and hundreds of civilian casualties in Pakistan. And the New York Times article just mentioned that he was killed and Obama had to wring his hands and sit there and figure out whether he wanted to kill his wife and his kids with him or not. But what we fail to bring up is the backstory to that particular targeted attack. When Obama was in Egypt making a speech in June 2009 to the Islamic world, the U.S. killed a mid-ranking Taliban official named Khawaz Wali Massoud. And later on, some administration officials gave an interview to the Washington Post in which it turned out that they had killed this guy because they were hoping that Baitullah Masood would show up at this guy's funeral. So we killed this guy. Five guys were killed with Khawaz Wali Masood. Later that day, there was a funeral for him. About 5,000 people showed up. We struck again with drones. We killed up to 83 people. Some reports say up to 45 civilians. Even in that drone strike, Baitullah Masood escaped. A few weeks later, we killed him in that strike where Obama had to sit there and figure out whether it's morally responsible to be killing this guy. So this is just one case that we know of what's actually going on in that part of the world. We don't know, if they're killing people because they're doing jumping jacks or because they have a long beard or, they fit some sort of signature that we're looking for bad guys. So to the rest of the world, there's no moral controversial issue here. It's pretty clear-cut what's going on.
So I wonder, for people of like my generation, it's like the shades of Vietnam on some levels. When you hear a description of and see things in war, but you see that the whole villages are surrounded during Vietnam and created these zones and people were killed inside those villages because you expected they were VC or whatever was going on. And it seems similar things seem to be going on, but in a more high tech version. And, I wonder, so this is, to me, it's almost like a logical extension of what I can remember from then. And on top of that, we look at not taking prisoners. Sam, I'd like you to comment on that. And also this whole question of not taking prisoners. I mean, for years, as the article points out, rendition did not end under Obama with his policies that was allowed to stay on. Whether we're still doing it or not, we don't know. People are still being detained. Prosecutions, if feasible, clearly not. If you don't capture anybody, you can't prosecute them. So, this takes us to a kind of a dangerous situation. In some ways, some would argue. that you can't kill your way out of this. But can you? But where will that take us if we keep kind of just doing assassinations and nobody is captured, no trials are taking place?
Yeah, is that a question for me?
That was you, Sam. I'm sorry, I was a little rambling. I apologize. Go ahead.
Look, my personal opinion, I think it's self-evident that we've made a decision that we're not going to capture folks.
And why do you think that is?
I think that's a purely political decision. I mean, in other words, we have an administration in power that has spent so much capital on attacking everything associated with previous capture operations that there's no way they want to go down that road. Now, I say that as somebody, as you well know, that by no means endorsed all of the practices that were associated with previous capture operations, especially the enhanced interrogation techniques like waterboarding, which I've been on record as opposing for a long time. But I think it is indefensible from any critical reasoning or logical standpoint that we're not capturing people but we would prefer simply to kill them and thereby deprive them of all their human rights. And I think the whole drone thing, I mean, you're right, it raises a bunch of new issues. It exaggerates some old ones. We have had for decades an issue in this country where the president increasingly has usurped onto himself the authority to wage war overseas. Instead of declaring war and making a national decision and having a declaration of war, we increasingly have gone to a system where the president just makes that decision. And, people have talked about a volunteer army, how taking away the outcry that goes with draftees being killed perhaps has made it easier for the president to involve us abroad. Well, my God, when you eliminate the human casualty factor completely and you're effectively now using robots, that just takes us that much further down the road. And to echo something that I think was said just a few moments ago, you know, the drones may seem very antiseptic. That's a horrible word, but to some people on our side, because we're not suffering any casualties and we're hitting targets. But I mean, armed aircraft violating the airspace of sovereign nations and launching missile attacks on people in broad daylight that's not stealth. That's not invisible. That's about as blatant and in-your-face as you can be. And as critical as I've been to the Pakistanis and continue to be, expecting them to ignore a half dozen such strikes a year is one thing. Expecting them to ignore, sometimes a half dozen in a week, that's a really different proposition. I mean, again, as critical as I've been of them, it's not surprising that they've had enough.
And I think in some ways in your piece, Scott, I mean, you didn't allude to it, but you kind of laid out these ideas that could be taking place, that many people argue that these decisions not to capture people are very political, and especially during an election, and it kind of fits into our image in America of the cowboy image of being able to do what we need to do and get it done. And again, feeding into the whole idea of continuing growing war in many ways, in a new kind of war that we're not defining, but without any congressional consent.
Yeah, I mean, one of the peculiar things about this this drone program is that it technically is top secret. In Pakistan, it's run by the CIA and is a covert action program. No one's allowed to talk about it. In Yemen and Somalia, for the most part, the military has taken the lead role, but it's still a secret program. But of course, when things blow up on the ground, it's not secret. You know, it's certainly not a secret to the people down on the ground. And kind of in recognition of that, U.S. officials have been willing to talk, usually on an anonymous basis, and give limited information about the program. But one of the odd things about this is here we are going into a whether you like it or you don't like it, a totally new kind of combat, totally new kind of weapons, all kinds of legal questions and moral and political questions surrounding it, and there has not been a debate in Congress about it, because there can't be, because they're not allowed to talk about it. And I've literally been on panels with a mix of government executive branch officials, journalists, and members of Congress, and the journalists can talk about it, but the executive branch folks and the congressional folks who actually know something aren't allowed to talk about it. And we have entered this new era in a strange way with very little, kind of open debate of the kind that you expect in a democracy.
See, Umar, one of the things that I think that when I read what you've written, and one of the questions this raises, of course, is what Scott and Sam were just describing. We have a war being redefined because of the weaponry that we're using. It becomes a secret war. So then, secret in the sense we can't talk about it. So we're having wars that, in essence, are not being declared and being fought in a very stealth way, and there's no oversight at all, whether it's congressional oversight of secret congressional oversight or open congressional oversight or anything in the public. And that to me is probably the slippery zone that may worry people about where the future is taking us.
Yeah, I think, we talk about the difficulty of capturing these people instead of killing them.
Yeah.
And one, the major difficulty is not necessarily that part of Pakistan or that part of Somalia is physically dangerous to go into. Actually, in a place like Pakistan, the major difficulty would be convincing Pakistan that these people we have enough evidence for you to extradite these people to us. The major difficulty is that we may not have a case against a lot of these people that we end up killing. In that sense, that's where this war is going. This isn't an entirely unprecedented situation. Israel has been carrying out targeted killings for decades and decades, and they may have a lower number of, lower number of Israeli casualties now than they did in the 90s, but they've ended up having to build, a wall that's tens of meters high going across their country. So we do have some precedent for this type of policy of targeted killing and whether or not it leads us to a more peaceful situation or not, We really need to ask ourselves whether or not we want to keep going to the airport and having, people stick their hands into our crotches and checking us, or whether we want to sort of end this sort of tension that we have in the world and we want to sort of move on. Because it's not going to end if we keep shooting these guys in different parts of the world. There's not a finite number of them.
And I suppose, Scott, and coming back to you before we go back, close out and go to Sam, is that if anything, like what you're writing has left me with these questions about, perhaps limited warfare like this that doesn't involve tens of thousands of people being killed and on the ground might be the way people want to see war go. Maybe it's not. But the question is, without any oversight beyond that, without any oversight from the civilian government, from Congress, from our elected representatives, that's the part I think that just kind of screamed at me in your article that really needs questioning.
Yeah, I mean it has been very strange. For example, when President Obama took what I think is probably an unprecedented step of approving the strike that killed Anwar al-Awlaki, again this
American-born
guy. That morning he was at a military event, and he said something like, "Anwar al-Awlaki is dead," but didn't quite say how that had happened, but then said, congratulations or thanks are due to, the brave men and women of our intelligence community, something like that. So it was sort of, is this secret or is this not secret? He certainly was implying what everybody knew, which was that the CIA had killed al-Awlaki with a drone strike, but he wasn't fully, taking responsibility for it. So I think we're in this kind of weird nether zone that I suspect is going to have to at some point be resolved in favor of greater transparency and debate for this program.
Sam, and again, let me let you kind of conclude for us here before we take a break. I'm just thinking that your thoughts as somebody who's really kind of wrestled with these things and I don't see as taking positions as liberal or conservative, left or right often, but it can come from any place. what are your thoughts on this? I mean, because you've been in the field.
I think you're telling me that I don't have any moral anchor. I think that's.
I did not say that, Sam.
Let me put it this way. The existence of clandestinity in an organization was designed so that you could conduct operations and hide them from your adversaries, right? That's what the justification is for being able to conduct things in a clandestine fashion. It's not supposed to be so you can get away with things vis-a-vis your own people. Now, we obviously crossed that bridge a long time ago because administrations for a long time have succumbed to the intention to put things in clandestine channels that they can't politically do. But this is, we're now off into the direction of basically waging war without answering to anybody other than the President of the United States. Effectively, you wonder, are we or are we not a republic overseas, right? Does the Congress only apply to domestic actions? I that's clearly wrong. This is out of balance. We got to get it back in balance. The President doesn't have, he's not a monarch. He's not a king. He can't just make these decisions.
Well, this has been Scott Shane. First of all, I want to thank you for the investigative work you do in bringing your articles to the table, so to speak.
thanks for having me, Mark.
It's a pleasure to have you on here. Scott Shane, we will. You can go to his article, Secret Kill Tests, Obama's Principles, from the New York Times. It'll be on our website as well. It was Umar Farouk's articles and his blog, Immoral Joe Moore, will be there. Umar Farouk, Scott Shane, Sam Faddis, the same with Sam Faddis's work, will be there on the web as well. Thank all three of you for joining us, and I look forward to talking to you all again.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Take care. Folks, we're going to take a very brief break and come back. We're going to meet some young people who have created a documentary investigating the schools in the city of Baltimore. Looking forward to that. The Intersection Kids, students, I should say. And we'll be right back with them, so please don't go away.